By the same standard, cartoonists, editors, and publishers of the French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo, who have made a habit of mocking Islamic figures and sanctities, should also be detained and put trial. But unfortunately, prejudice against Muslims has been essentially normalized, and Western double standards in this regard are only fueling the flames of Islamophobia.
The story of Saudi Arabia. Part 2. Saudi Arabia these days has made headlines in many parts of the world, from its domestic politics and relations with the US to its ground and aerial attacks on Yemen. But one of these developments was very important and strange. Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who was once the most trusted journalist of the royal family, went missing in a peculiar way. He entered the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, but never came out. After an hour, his fiancée, who was waiting outside, informed his colleagues at the Washington Post via social media. And after several days, Jamal Khashoggi grabbed the headlines across the world. The operation that was aimed at eliminating Khashoggi turned into the biggest scandal in Saudi history. But the point is that Saudi Arabia and Turkey have their stories connected to one another in a strange place, in Istanbul, or the ancient city of Constantinople, the capital city of the Ottoman Empire, which goes back to 100 years ago when the First World War ended, the Ottoman Empire collapsed, and Saudi Arabia was born. Geographical maps have not remained unchanged. Today's borderlines between nations and regions have seen constant changes over the centuries. Some people have come, put a pen on the map, and changed the lines as they wished and thought it was better, placing people on each side of the borderlines, and stories after stories have unfolded. This is Sarajevo, a city whose strange events at the beginning of the 20th century decided the world's fate several decades later. Sarajevo is located in Bosnia that was annexed by the Austro-Hungarian Empire several years before the war. But the neighboring Serbia was opposed to the move because it was seeking to expand the Balkan region through uniting Slavs, and from 1914 onwards was creating unrest and insecurity in different Bosnian cities. The long-awaited day was June the 28th, 1914, when Franz Ferdinand, the heir to the throne of Austro-Hungary, was in Sarajevo on an official visit. Ferdinand and his wife were leaving Sarajevo's municipality when they were assassinated by 19-year-old Bosnian nationalist Gavrilo Princip. The young man had been armed by the Serbs. On July the 23rd, the Austro-Hungarian government demanded an investigation into the assassination, which was rejected by Serbia. In less than 3 months, the assassination made that time's big European powers engage in a brutal and complicated conflict. The Allies believed that a battlefield should be changed somewhere behind the enemy front where it could be stabbed in the back. One of these plans on the map was to gain access to Ottoman borders from behind. The Ottoman Empire had become a strong ally of Germany months after the start of the war and had turned into an effective force on the front line. Shortly after the start of the war in November of 1914, and after the Ottoman Empire officially joined the war, its caliph, in the middle of regular demonstrations in Constantinople, declared war on Britain. While Ottoman troops were preparing to fight the Allies, Saudi deserts were chosen as the venue to infiltrate the Ottoman borders. Assistant of British Secretary of War, Herbert Kitchener, informed him that a person proper to accept ruling Muslims had already made contact. That person was the ruler of Mecca, whose name was Hussein ibn Ali. In 1908, Ottoman King Abdul Hamid II appointed Hussein ibn Ali as the Sharif of Mecca and ruler of Hejaz. The title of Sharif was given to an individual who was descended from Prophet Muhammad, and Sharif Hussein was from Hashim clan. After Sultan Abdul Hamid II was deposed by the Committee of Unity and Progress, a silent war gradually broke out between Sharif Hussein and the Young Turks as he was attempting to gain more independence in Hejaz. Sharif Hussein was playing with both sides of the battle, the Ottomans and the British, to buy time and find a solution in future. At the same time, he was also consulting with his tough rival in eastern Saudi Arabia, Abdul Aziz bin Saud. In January 1915, British Secretary of War Herbert Kitchener, after getting approval from the Foreign Office and to attract Arab-speaking people, took even another step and ordered the British agency in Cairo to issue a declaration stating that Britain would not only help Saudi Arabians, but also all Arab speakers in Asia, from Palestine and Syria to Mesopotamia, gain independence. Britain is also making attempts to attack the Ottomans elsewhere at the Dardanelles. If fighting is successful there, it will lead to the conquest of Constantinople and will create a significant divide between the Ottoman and German fronts. The conquest of Constantinople could also lead to the total collapse of the Ottoman Empire. On March 15, 1915, the British and French joint navy entered the scene. But Turkish forces deployed at the mouth of Dardanelles and armed with heavy artillery and underwater minefields prevented them from entering the strait. They sank three warships and caused heavy damage to seven others. 10 out of 18 warships that had entered were removed from the battlefield due to serious damage. Winston Churchill, the architect of the operation, was forced to step down after the defeat. However, a month later, British military officials made a new attempt to deploy forces off the Turkish coast of Gallipoli. They had decided to seize the Ottoman artillery to make up for their defeat at the Dardanelles. But This battle shortly turned into a war of attrition as well. The jubilation of the Allies in the early days of the battle turned into a historic regret. 500,000 people from each side had come to the arena, half of whom never returned home. The war that took Britain a step closer to the conquest of the Middle East ended up in a bitter defeat. All these events made Hejaz, which was a remote place in the scorching dry deserts of Saudi Arabia, gain more and more importance. Saudi Arabia was far from the center of Ottoman power, known as Bab al-Ali in Constantinople, and there were very few connecting roads, and the rulers there had already collaborated with the British front. In July 1915, ruler of Mecca, Sharif Hussein, wrote a letter to British High Commissioner in Cairo, Sir Henry McMahon. In that letter, Sharif Hussein announced his readiness to cooperate with Britain against the Ottoman rule only if Britain supported the independence of the Hashemite Kingdom, a monarchy that ruled over the entire Arabian Peninsula, Mesopotamia, and the Levant. Sharif Hussein was after all the Arabian regions, from the Persian Gulf coast to the Mediterranean coast, which was something London was not willing to accept. Sharif Hussein had a serious rival in Saudi Arabia, who was Abdul Aziz bin Saud. Britain was negotiating with several different clients for the Arab lands. When the British Secretary of War was pulling out his remaining troops of the Dardanelles, one of his assistants, Sir Mark Sykes, returned to London from a long trip to the Middle East. He came on the scene by submitting a plan to Kitchener to launch a revolution in the Middle East in order to change course in the battle against the Ottomans. Sir Mark Sykes was an experienced journalist on Ottoman affairs and a British embassy officer in Constantinople for 4 years. Therefore, Britain began a complicated game to win the hearts of the Arabs without giving them a clear and unequivocal commitment so that they would not act in favor of the Ottomans and until the fate of the Arab regions is decided following the war. France was another client of the Arab lands. France, since the Crusades, had claims on Syria, Lebanon, and Palestine, and now it should be consulted about these regions because it had sent 8 million troops to the battlefield during the First World War and was seriously involved on the Western Front. Therefore, it was important for Britain to consider France's share in the future of the post-war Middle East. For this reason, the British Foreign Office asked the French government to send an envoy to London for negotiations on the future borders of Syria. French envoy François-Georges Picot went to London. At that time, Georges Picot served as the French consul general in Beirut and was aware of France's covetousness in the Arab regions of Syria and Lebanon. Picot was a staunch member of the colonialist faction, and therefore the French government could not find anyone better than him to enter this difficult mission to take France's share from Britain. Negotiations began on November the 23rd, 1915. The negotiations on the future of the Middle East were completely confidential and held only between France and Britain without the presence of other parties. A review of reports from that meeting shows that although France and Britain were apparently on the same front, they clashed over every single part of the Arabian regions. The de Bunsen Committee believed that Britain should divide the regions in a way that those under French rule would stretch from the Mediterranean coasts of Syria and Lebanon to Mosul Governorate. Britain was even ready to relinquish Mosul despite its vast oil reserves, but use France to protect itself against Russia. The presence of France would prevent Russia's infiltration into southern regions. At the end of the day, both Sykes and Picot achieved what they wanted without seeking views of the millions of people living in those regions. The map of the Arabian regions was put on the table, and French and British envoys began drawing the border lines in the absence of representatives of the residents of those regions. All these events happened while Arab groups such as Sharif Hussein and Ibn Saud were engaged in battles with the Ottomans in the hope that they would gain independence following promises by these governments. The border lines on the map were once again being altered, bringing changes to the lives of millions of people in the Arabian regions. Finally, and after a series of meetings, it was agreed that France rules the Great Lebanon and the rest of Syrian soil is put under its exclusive influence, and these regions extend as far as Mosul. Britain got Basra and Baghdad, both of them Mesopotamian regions. Britain also took the ports of Akkar and Haifa in Palestine so that it can build a railroad from the Mediterranean to Mesopotamia. The rest of the region was put under the supervision of a kind of international management. The remaining parts of the Middle East would form an Arabian government or a coalition of governments, which was nominally independent but was practically under the influence of Britain and France. The Sykes-Picot Treaty was approved by France and Britain in early February 1916, but it was kept confidential until 2 years later, when the fate of the war was settled. The treaty later became known as the Sykes-Picot Agreement, only after the two countries agreed on the border lines and made their own gains from their negotiations. Sharif Hussein began an uprising to capture Arab lands on June the 16th, 1916. The uprising had Britain's all-out support. But it had little success and was halted by Ottoman airstrikes in a short period of time. According to the Arab Bulletin published by the British Foreign Office's headquarters in Cairo, the uprising by Sharif Hussein practically failed a year after it began, costing Britain £11 million. London now expected Sharif Hussein's forces to only support themselves. those days, Egypt was under control of Britain. The country previously was part of the Ottoman Empire, but shortly after the Committee of Union and Progress joined the German front, the Egyptian king extended his hand of friendship to London. By order of the British Foreign Office, a central bureau called the Arabian Administration was opened in Cairo, which focused on the Arabian regions of the Middle East. The British Foreign Office began recruiting staff for the newly established bureau, which was headed by David George Hogarth, an intelligence officer who had studied archaeology at Oxford University. He brought to Cairo a young man called Thomas Edward Lawrence, who had worked with him at the Ashmolean Museum of Oxford University. The young man was later known as the Lawrence of Arabia. Lawrence, who was 28 years old, had been exempted from military service because he was slightly built. He had previously been employed as a second lieutenant and translator in the geography department of the Ministry of War and had been dispatched to the Middle East on a cartography mission.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
For years, the Zionist regime's excavations have been ongoing underneath Palestinian homes in Al-Quds. Some of these excavations are publicly declared, others are hidden. According to Wadi Helve Information Center, the Zionist regime has started digging tunnels under Al-Quds neighborhood in order to search for antiquities. But the undeclared goal is to establish a network of tunnels that reach the bottom of Al-Aqsa Mosque and shake its foundations. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote in this regard, Kayed al-Rajabi didn't expect that winter would bring destruction to his small home in Al-Quds. Heavy rains led to the collapse of a part of the house's roof and the injury of one of his children. In his house in Batn al-Hawa neighborhood, al-Rajabi, a few days ago, was surprised by the collapse of a part of the roof during heavy rains, which caused his child to injure his leg. Eight people live in the house, including his elderly mother. Al-Rajabi told the Palestine Chronicle, "We were at home hearing the sound of thunder and trying to warm up the places as much as possible when we were surprised by the collapse. It was scary and we all ran outside. However, the rainy weather is not the only reason behind this, as there are other reasons that lead to the collapse of Palestinian homes in the city of Quds, especially in the town of Silwan." Palestinians accused the Zionist regime's authorities of playing a major role in that. For years, Israeli regime's excavations have been ongoing underneath Palestinian homes in the town. Some of these excavations are publicly declared, others are hidden. According to Wadi Halwa Information Center, the fabricated regime of Israel has started digging tunnels under Al-Quds neighborhood in order to search for antiquities. But the undeclared goal is to establish a network of tunnels that reach the bottom of Al-Aqsa Mosque and shake its foundations. Excavation work continues in a network of ramified tunnels under the Wadi Halwa neighborhood all the way to Al-Buraq Square, the western wall of the mosque. The center added that the digging and slitting of tunnels have been going on under the Wadi Halwa neighborhood for 13 years, and this led to widespread landslides, cracks, and fissures in several areas of the neighborhood, especially in the main street, mosque, and kindergarten. Additionally, more than 80 houses were partially damaged, while 5 buildings were classified as dangerous by the Israeli regime occupation municipality after the foundations were damaged. Recently, the backyard of one of the houses in Ras al-Amud neighborhood collapsed, posing a great danger to its residents. This event revealed the existence of a large hollow space under the house, suggesting that Israeli regime machinery has been excavating in that area. In the Abu Taya neighborhood, similar collapses occurred under the houses, and the residents miraculously survived. But this time, the reasons were different. Ahmad Abu Taya, one of the residents in the neighborhood, said that the cause of the collapse is the negligence of the Israeli regime occupation municipality in Al-Quds, as it prevented the construction of a retaining wall to protect the houses. It also prevents any repairs to the structures under various pretexts. Abu Taya said, "The Israeli municipality does not allow us to make any repairs inside our homes. For example, if a wall needs support, we are not allowed to build it even if it is dangerous for our lives." In contrast, the Israeli regime occupation municipality quickly grants the necessary permits to the illegal Jewish Zionist settlement outpost inside the town and allows for any construction works that may be needed, Abu Taya told Palestine Chronicle. In fact, the excavation and construction work carried out by the settlers leads to great damage to the old Palestinian homes. Moreover, after refusing to allow them the necessary permits, the Israeli regime authorities often ask the Palestinian residents to evacuate their homes under the pretext that these homes have become dangerous for habitation. The Wadi Halwa Information Center explains that there are various dangers resulting from this. When the residents are forced to leave their homes, the buildings eventually fall under the control of the Israeli regime occupation municipality, which over time passes the ownership to the illegal Zionist settlers. Meanwhile, the excavation work below the Wadi Halwa neighborhood never stops, as demonstrated by specialized trucks that transport the dust emptied from the bottom of the ground. When Palestinians ask, through a lawyer, to enter the tunnels and monitor the works, the Israeli occupation authorities prevent them from doing so, the center said. Zionist Jewish settlement groups claim that these tunnels are part of the search for Jewish antiquities in the region. These efforts are concentrated in the town of Silvan, which the settlers call the City of David, although until now, no Jewish antiquities have been found to support these baseless claims, the digging continues, causing the collapse of Palestinian homes and a constant threat to the lives of the Palestinian residents.
This is
a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. This is For a Better Life from IRIB English Radio. I am your host, Sayyid Mahdi Tawakkul. My today topic is about the importance of being friendly to others. As usual, I need to add that whatever I say is based on the Quran and Islamic traditions. Being pleasant and friendly to others and being nice and polite when we are with others can attract many achievements to us. A cheerful man, or in better words, someone who is behaving in a way that shows he is happy, can light up the room. He can inspire others to achieve their goals. Such a person can bring a feeling of felicity and happiness, and a feeling of well-being and contentment wherever he goes. Being cheerful involves a positive perspective on life for both the man who is cheerful and others who are with him. By being cheerful, it does not mean that the man is really happy and that he does not have any concern and problems in his life. Rather, to show happiness means that someone behaves in such a way to conceal his problems and do not show it to others. There could be someone who is sad, someone who is in predicament situations, but does not let others realize it and behave in such a way to not let others understand it. And this is the manner of acting that a cheerful man does. Unfortunately, many of us tend to focus on our problems. And in addition, we usually take our blessings and achievements for granted. And this is really problematic. Yes, it is natural to think about the difficulties we face and the challenges we have in our life. But it is natural, if we want to realize them, to think about them in order to overcome them. But if we focus more on the negative side of our life, there is a real danger that it may let us down. It would make us unsatisfied with the blessings we have in our life. But if we pay more attention to the positive part of the way we are living, it will give us a positive lift, and gradually paying attention to the positive side of our life will become a fixed habit for us. As a result, we will behave in a way that shows we are blessed, we are happy, and totally fortunate. This attitude has a positive effect of human behavior, and gradually, when we are with others, we treat them satisfactorily.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
As I said several times, we have this experience in our life that based on the law of attraction, positive feeling catches positive signals and delivers happiness to others. As a result, being pleasant and friendly also make other people happy and let them feel better. When we make an effort to be more cheerful, we can sense that life is becoming easier. We feel we have more energy. We are more motivated. And being cheerful let our general well-being and outlook improve. By being friendly, we can improve the whole atmosphere as well. Our feeling dominates the atmosphere, just as the miserable person can let the spirit of other people down. Similarly, a cheerful people can brighten them and make everyone feel lighter and happier. For example, a teacher who behaves in a satisfactory way helps his student to be more confident, less stressful. His students are more confident to speak in the class. The student in a cheerful environment can learn more, offer better ideas, and offer better thoughts. Imam Ali has got an interesting saying in this regard, and accentuates on the point that how being friendly can attract others' attention. The Imam says in a short but meaningful sentence, "Al-bashashatu hibalatul mawaddah." To be friendly is like a trap that is set by the person to catch love and kindness. Undoubtedly, pleasant and well-mannered people who deal with others with open faces and smiling lips, they will have many friends. And on the contrary, people who face others with a tense, sullen, and angry face, others do not love them, and they detest to be with them. Just imagine a society that is people show pleasance and satisfaction, that how much this society can be a good environment for positive movement and positive activity. Here I need to again repeat that by showing joyfulness and cheerfulness, I don't want to say that we try just to be like an actor or an actress who is playing and performing a role, not at all. The reality of what I am going to point is that we need to train ourselves in such a way that when we are with other people, do not convey our sorrows and depression to them. Do not transfer our problem to them, and do not let them be aware that we have problem in our life. With just a simple smile on face, especially when we see other people, when we are with our friend, we can sense that our friend gains energy, feels better, feels that something good is going to happen in his life. Just this, with a simple smile and an open face. We do not need to use up our energy to show happiness, to show positivity. Not at all. You should not be that much energetic to show that, to pretend to be a good man. No, just a simple smile, just a warming greeting, just not to frown, not to turn sour, not to look bad-tempered. This is sufficient and is enough. It is also narrated from the Prophet to have said, "Ya Bani Abdul Muttalib," or the offspring of Abdul Muttalib. They were the Prophet's relatives from the tribe of Quraysh. "Innakum lan tasa'u an-nas bi-amwalikum." You cannot assist to help people with your wealth and property, because people's need is much higher than your wealth. فَأَلْغُوهُمْ بِثَلَاقَةَ الْوَجْحِ وَحُسْنِ الْبِشْرِ. But instead, meet them with an open face and cheerfulness. Wealth would not be sufficient to meet people's need, but kindness is an imperishable capital and a source of happiness for people. In many cases, we have seen that when we see a friend or a relative and smile at them, they also smile at us and feels pleased. So far, we were talking about how important being cheerful and friendly to others is. Unfortunately, the time is ending, and inshallah, if we have time, we will talk about this topic in another situation. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand, he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash, he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share, he knows.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
In the US, the Supreme Court has been wary of weakening Section 230 to allow lawsuits against internet giants and technology firms. We take a look at the US media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Los Angeles Times has covered this story and tells us more. Several Supreme Court justices said on Tuesday, 21st of February, that they were wary of allowing lawsuits against YouTube and other social media firms over algorithms they use to direct users to related content, even if that encourages terrorists or promotes illegal conduct. The Supreme Court justices had agreed for the first time to hear a challenge to Section 230. The federal law that shields websites from being sued over content posted by others. That set off alarms at big technology firms. But during Tuesday's arguments, Justices Elena Kagan and Brett Kavanaugh said Congress, and not the court, should decide whether to change the law. You know, these are not like the 9 greatest experts on the internet, Justice Elena Kagan said to Laughter, referring to the 9 Supreme Court justices. She said it was very difficult to draw a line between ordinary algorithms that tell users they may be interested in similar videos and those that encourage certain individuals to look at suspect or harmful content. Isn't drawing the line something for Congress and not the court? She asked. Supreme Court Justice Kavanaugh said he too thought this might be a time for judicial restraint. He said dozens of technology firms and business groups had warned that changing Section 230 would crash the digital economy with all sorts of effects on workers and consumers, retirement plans and what have you, and those are serious concerns. He said Congress was in a better position to revise its own law if needed, particularly when courts of law have upheld Section 230 as a broad legal shield since 1996. Are we really the right body to draw back from that understanding? He asked, strongly suggesting he thought the answer was no. Chief Justice John Roberts was also wary of opening the door to lawsuits. While the case before the court concerned terrorism, he said it could lead to a wave of lawsuits based on personal or business complaints. Other justices admitted they were confused and uncertain about the arguments before them. It did not sound as if a majority were ready to rule for the California parents suing Google and YouTube over the death of their daughter in a 2015 terrorist attack in Paris, France. The case of Gonzalez versus Google asked whether YouTube could be held liable for using computerized programs that recommended terrorist videos to potential recruits. A federal judge and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal threw out that claim on the grounds that Section 230 shielded online sites from being sued over content posted by others. A lawyer for the family of Noemi Gonzalez argued on Tuesday, 21st of February, that Google, which owns YouTube, should be subject to a lawsuit because of its own actions. It was encouraging people to look at ISIS videos, said Eric Schnapper, a University of Washington law professor. Professor Schnapper explained he was referring to a YouTube feature that shows a list of similar or related videos to the one on screen. Deputy Solicitor General Malcolm Stewart, representing the Justice Department and the Biden administration, took the side of the plaintiffs, but stressed that the social media sites could not be sued over terrorist-made ISIS videos appearing on their platforms. Rather, they should be liable for targeted recommendations that encourage potential recruits to view similar terrorist-made ISIS videos. Both ran into mostly skeptical questions, including from Justice Clarence Thomas. In the past, Justice Thomas has argued that websites should not be shielded from liability if they knowingly post illegal or defamatory conduct and refuse to remove it. But that issue was not presented in Tuesday's case. Justice Clarence Thomas said on Tuesday he was not convinced by the plaintiff's argument that YouTube recommends videos to users. Someone interested in cooking is shown other videos related to cooking. I see those as suggestions and not recommendations, he said. The outcome may become clearer on Wednesday, 22nd of February, when the justices hear a related case involving a 2016 law that allows victims of international terrorism to sue those who knowingly aided and abetted the terrorists. That in turn led to several lawsuits against YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter that arose from ISIS-sponsored terrorist incidents. The plaintiffs in that case argued that social media sites aided the terrorists who carried out an attack in Istanbul, Turkey. Lawsuits for Twitter said the lawsuit should be dismissed because there was no evidence that Twitter postings had any effect on the terrorists who carried out the crime in Istanbul. CNBC has also covered this story and tells us more. Supreme Court justices voiced hesitation on Tuesday, 21st of February, about upending a key legal shield that protects technology companies from liability for their users' posts and for how the companies moderate messages on their websites. Justices across the ideological spectrum expressed concern with breaking the delicate balance set by Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act as they rule on the pivotal case, Gonzalez versus Google, even as some suggested a narrower reading of the liability shield could sometimes make sense. The current case was brought by the family of an American killed in a 2015 terrorist attack in Paris, France. The petitioners argued that Google, through its subsidiary YouTube, violated the Anti-Terrorism Act by aiding and abetting ISIS terrorists, also known as Daesh terrorists, as it promoted the group's videos through its recommendation algorithm. Lower courts of law sided with Google, saying Section 230 protects the company from being held liable for third-party content posted on its service. The petitioners contend that YouTube's recommendations actually constitute the company's own speech, which would fall outside the bounds of the liability shield. But the Supreme Court justices struggled to understand where the petitioners' counsel, Eric Schnapper, was drawing the line on what counts as content created by YouTube itself. Conservative Justice Samuel Alito at one point said he was completely confused by the distinction that Schnapper tried to draw between YouTube's own speech and that of a third party. Schnapper repeatedly pointed to the thumbnail image YouTube chose users to display what video is coming up next, or is suggested based on their views. He said that thumbnail was a joint creation between YouTube and the third party that posted the video. In this case, the terrorist group ISIS, also known as Daesh, because YouTube contributes the URL. But several chief court justices questioned whether that argument would apply to any attempt to organize information from the internet, including a search engine results page. They expressed concern that such a broad interpretation could have far-reaching effects the High Court may not be prepared to predict. Conservative Justice Brett Kavanaugh noted that courts have applied Section 230 consistently since its inception in the 1990s, and pointed to the Amici beliefs that warned overhauling the interpretation would cause massive economic consequences for many businesses, as well as their workers, consumers, and investors. Chief Justice Kavanaugh said, "Those are serious concerns Congress could consider if it sought to rework the statute. But the Supreme Court," he said, "is not equipped to account for that."
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Russian influence is growing in Africa. From West Africa in countries such as Mali and Burkina Faso to South Africa, the continent's most advanced economy. Western propaganda to isolate Russia has failed miserably. A demonstrator in the Central African Republic, a former French colony, says Russia has played a positive role in his country.
"We recognize a friend in suffering. When we were in crisis, it was Russia that came to our rescue to liberate the country. We saw France, which was there but did nothing, and France continues to bully us. We have to tell certain truths today. Russia is coming to liberate us. Now we are free, and we must support Russia at all cost until our last breath. Russia came to our country in the moment of crisis. Our country has suffered. Our country has been mistreated by the rebels. And that is why we came to support Russia."
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of news and events making headlines in Africa. Today we are focusing on the unfolding Cold War in Africa between Russia and Western powers. African countries are, meanwhile, reasserting their independence while rejecting Western imperialism and neocolonialism. We're asking, will African countries succeed in their move to stop Western powers intent on meddling and countering Russia in the continent? The second part of our show today will be on continuing exploitation of Western and Central African countries by France through the CFA franc currency. Our experts today will give us their incisive analysis on these two subjects, and you can be part of the conversation by sending us your comments through our social media handle.
Russia-West New Cold War in Africa. Russia has been making diplomatic inroads in African countries that were seen as backyards of Western neocolonial powers, especially France. The US-led NATO military alliance has been angered by Russia's increasing influence in Africa, particularly at this time that the alliance is indirectly engaged in a military conflict with Russia in Ukraine.
Most African countries have refused to back NATO in its conflict with Russia. In fact, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa has blamed NATO for the war in Ukraine.
The war could have been avoided if NATO had heeded the warnings from amongst its own leaders and officials over the years that its eastward expansion would lead to greater, not less, instability in the region.
Well, to discuss increasing neo-Cold War rivalry between Russia and NATO in Africa, we have contacted Nefta Freeman, a coordinating committee member of the Black Alliance for Peace. Thanks for your time today. Now, over the recent months, we have seen a flurry of diplomatic activity with top-ranking U.S. and Russian officials visiting Africa while Germany unveiled a new strategy for Africa. Now, are we witnessing a new Cold War in Africa amid the NATO-Russia conflict in Ukraine?
Yes, the heightened engagement with Africa is unquestionably a part of a new Cold War by the West, led by the United States. It has been waging a Cold War against Russia and China in particular. So this is playing out in Africa as a new scramble for Africa. Africa remains central to the global markets, supply of raw materials, and has become also a place of exporting finished goods to. But over the last decade, the competition has been increasingly militarized, notably with the U.S.-NATO destruction of Libya in 2011, and turning Africa into really pretty much a hotbed of violent and extremist activity, giving the U.S. and other Western countries, France and whatnot, this pretext to say, well, they have to help African countries with militarization, AFRICOM, U.S. Africa Command, and the French Foreign Legion, and these to come and stop the violent extremism that in fact, the U.S. is responsible, NATO is responsible for.
Uganda President Yoweri Museveni hosted Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and said he saw no reason to criticize Russia over its military operation in Ukraine. Museveni said Russia has a long history of backing African liberation when the continent was colonized by Western colonial powers.
The Africans started organizing, led by new forces. And the first group was in South Africa in 1912, when the African National Congress was founded. That was now the modern African anti-colonial resistance movement. Fortunately, and that's how Russia comes in 1917, a new force took over Russia. These were the Bolsheviks. I don't know what problems you have with the Bolsheviks, whether you like them or you don't, but for us, we appreciate them because they supported us. They started supporting our anti-colonial struggle, and that is our relationship with Russia. Russia, so the Soviet Union, supporting the anti-colonial movement in Africa.
Russian foreign minister visited Africa in February, and this was his third visit to the continent.